A lecture by John Avery, the 14th of May, 2011.
Arne asked me to talk about where some of the ideas in this book, Crisis 21, which tries to look at all of the problems facing us today in the 20th century, look at all of them and see how they're linked together to try to find an holistic approach to solving them. So what are these problems? They're well known. Everyone knows them, but it's still useful to make a list and think about what they are. Well, the one is the threat to the environment. We know that both the excessive consumption in the industrialized countries and rapid population growth in the developing countries is putting too much stress on the global environment. One thing that might not be realized by everyone is that the global warming is really a long-term process because the thermal inertia of the ocean is so great. It goes very slowly and is going to continue, not just this century, but only the next, but also for thousands of years, global warming is going to continue. So one thing that we might see, not this century, none of us will see it, but still we have to think about our grandchildren and great-grandchildren, and that is that if all of the ice in Greenland melts, that corresponds to a 7-meter rise in the sea level. And if all of the ice in the West Antarctic ice sheet also melts, that would be another 5 meters, so that would be 12 meters. And so you can say that all of the buildings in Copenhagen, the nice old buildings, they perhaps not be there in 200 years. Another problem that we face in the 21st century is that the fossil fuel era is ending. You know, in the 70s, there was a book published by the Club of Rome called Limits to Growth, and that was very much criticized because they predicted the end of oil and so on by that and that date. Now we use a different model for the end of resources. The new way of looking at resources is to say that when a non-renewable resource is roughly half used, then there's a peak in the production and use of that resource. And why is that? It is because at that point, the mining or pumping of oil wells becomes more and more expensive, and the supply does not meet the demand, and therefore the price goes up. And as the price goes up, the use goes down. So there's some definite point where there's a peak in the production and use of the resource, and that's called the Hubbard peak. Hubbard peak, yeah. And now there's agreement that the Hubbard peak for oil, both oil and gas, it's happening really now. In the next decade, it will be the Hubbard peak for gas. The Hubbard peak for oil has already passed. So the prediction is that by 2050, both oil and gas will be so expensive that they won't be used for burning. They'll be used only for chemical synthesis. And within 100 years, the same will be true of coal. Also, metals. For metals, many of the important metals that we rely on for our industry have reserve indices between 10 and 100 years. And the reserve index is the size of the known reserves divided by the rate of use. So another problem going to have to be faced is to do with food. So if the petroleum is used up by 2050, this will be a very severe blow to global agriculture, because so much of modern agriculture depends on petroleum. In fact, some of the studies show that modern agriculture uses 10 calories of fossil fuel to get just 1 calorie of food. So agriculture will still be possible, but the modern way of doing it will not, and that will be a severe blow. Also, there's a link here to climate change, because the warming is producing melting in the Himalayan glaciers. And these glaciers supply the dry season water to both China and India. So also in South America, glaciers are melting, and they will no longer be able to supply water in the dry season to agriculture there. Also, the aquifers are being overdrawn, so the water tables are falling. Also, it's predicted that climate change will produce dryness in some of the regions that are now producing a lot of the world's grain, like the Middle West in USA. And this dryness will cause the harvest to fall. Another effect of climate change will be the rising of the sea level, which will affect the rice-producing areas in Bangladesh and Vietnam. Also, topsoil is being lost, and also agricultural land is lost to urbanization, paved over to make way for buildings and highways. So probably the weakest, economically weakest countries will feel this rise in food prices most severely. Someone asked Lester Brown whether China would suffer famine in the coming decades. And he said no, because the Chinese economy is so strong that they will just be able to buy the grain on the world market. But this lack of water from overpumping of the aquifer in China will produce starvation in Africa, because the economies there are so weak that they won't be able to buy the grain on the world market. So another of the problems that are facing us in the 21st century is intolerable economic inequality. Today, 2.7 billion people live on less than $2 a day, and 1.1 billion live on less than $1 a day. And every year, 18 million people die from causes that are related to poverty. That's quite a broad category, but if you add together all of the things that cause death, then 18 million deaths every year are somehow related to poverty. In 2006, 1.1 billion people lacked safe drinking water. And waterborne diseases killed 1.8 million people. And we also see in the developing countries that the infectious diseases that we thought we had conquered are coming back again. Resistant strains of malaria and resistant strains of tuberculosis. And of course, in Africa, HIV/AIDS. One of the biggest problems that we have today is the military-industrial complex that Eisenhower warned about in his farewell address. In 2008, the military budgets reached a total of $1.47 trillion. That's a trillion is a million. So that's 10 to the 12th. 1.47 times 10 to the 12 dollars. And it was still higher in 2010. It was 1.6 Milione, milione. So it's really hard to imagine this amount, but Franz and I were trying to find a way to imagine it. And the one thing that we came up with was that 2 days of military spending was enough to finance the whole of the World Health Organization's campaign to eradicate smallpox. Yeah. And the amount spent on military was five times the amount that would be needed to bring the poorest billion people in the world up to the next level, and essentially to eradicate undernourishment. So this enormous river of money, which is almost too great to imagine, is the thing which drives the war machine. So we have war, the war persists, even though we know it's insane, even though we know that it produces most of the suffering that people experience, even though we know it's threatening civilization, still it persists because it's driven by this huge river of money, which is enough to buy all of the senators and congressmen in Washington, and it's enough to buy all of the radio, or not radio, but television programs that we see on the big channels. All of them are bought, purchased, and paid for by this huge, huge amount of money. Another problem that we have to face is the fact that all during the era of industrialism, economists have, whole economy has been based on growth. The idea of growth was a kind of holy grail that people followed. And we are now coming close to the period where it will not be possible to have more growth. And if you think of unlimited growth, of course, it's an absurd idea. If you have 4% growth per year, that corresponds to a factor of 50 every century. If you have two centuries of 4% growth, that is a factor of 2,500. So obvious is obvious. This cannot go on. But our economists don't seem at least they don't want to tell us about this problem, and they refuse to look more than a short distance ahead. But we really need to soon to think about making a transition to another kind of economy that doesn't depend on growth for health. It has to be an economy that is a steady state. And that, I think, will require intervention of government. So then the final problem is nuclear war, which we have talked about before. And this is, of course, a problem that didn't go away at the end of the Cold War. I mean, many young people think that when the Cold War is over, the problem is gone. But of course it's not, because although there now are only half as many nuclear weapons as there were when the Cold War was at its height, it's still 20,600 nuclear weapons. And of those, 4,000 are on a high alert status. So one of the recent results of research is that a nuclear war would be an extreme ecological disaster that would affect all parts of the world, not just the countries involved in the war. The research shows that the smoke from burning cities would rise up to the stratosphere and stay there for a period of 10 years. And the smoke would block the sunlight, would destroy the ozone layer, and also block the hydrological cycle. And it would have a very, very severe effect on agriculture. In fact, the studies show that if, in the worst case scenario, all of the nuclear weapons on that are now on high alert were used in a war like that, it would produce a collapse of agriculture and a very large fraction of people and also a large fraction of animals and plants on Earth would die. So really, it is a catastrophe of huge proportions that is threatening us. And one wonders really by what right the nuclear nations threaten us with such a thing. So we're faced with all of these rather serious and difficult problems, but all of them have solutions. And the interesting thing about them is that they're linked. So we cannot just solve one problem, we have to solve them all at the same time. And one link that people might not think about so much is the link between poverty and war. I mean, of course, war causes poverty by destroying infrastructure, and in that way, you can see that war causes poverty. But there's another link, too. But also, we mentioned that the enormous amount of money that's now used for war, and if this had been used constructively, part of the problem of overpopulation could easily be solved, because the money could be used to provide universal medical service to everyone in the world, and to give women access to family planning materials and information. Also, another link is that war is used to maintain this shocking difference in wealth between the industrial countries and the developing countries. Of course, the colonial era is supposed to be over, but war is nevertheless linked very much with resources. It is used to put governments in power that will make deals with the industrial countries to take the resources out from the developing countries and keep them in the position of suppliers of resources. There's an author called Michael Clare who has studied this problem in detail. He has many books about it. And of course, the wars in the Middle East come to mind, where oil has been the motive. But Michael Clare has analyzed many other wars in Africa, for example, where other resources like metals have been involved. But then there's another link between poverty and war, which is a little harder to see, but it's there. And that is that if we want to get rid of war, we have to strengthen the United Nations. But the wealthy countries don't want that. And the reason they don't want it is that they're afraid of being taxed. They're afraid of losing their privileged position. So in order to strengthen the United Nations, we have to begin by working to get rid of this huge, huge difference between the rich and the poor. Actually, the European Union is very interesting in this aspect, because the European Union had the problem when all of the countries in the Eastern Europe were admitted, that the problem was that some parts of the Union were rich and others were poor. So what to do? Well, there were difficulties, but they were actually overcome, because the leaders of the European Union were clear that it was so valuable to have the union that some sacrifices had to be made. And these sacrifices were the money that had to be taken from the rich countries to bring up the economic level of the poorer ones. Well, there's a link also between the limits to growth and the need to move towards a sustainable energy system. Now we have come to an era where we're approaching a time where economic growth will not be possible. And therefore, unemployment will be a difficulty. And in order to solve this problem of unemployment, governments will have to step in and give jobs to unemployed workers. And these jobs ought to be related to the new infrastructure that we need to go over from the fossil fuel era to an era with renewable energy. So I think I'll stop at that point.
Okay. Yeah.
Yes, this is a link, of course, the food problem and the problem of huge economic inequality. The countries like Saudi Arabia are buying land in Africa, and actually many of the richer countries have bought huge amounts of land in Africa because I can see that there will be a global food problem. And I think that the United Nations ought to in some way establish a norm in this issue. I think United Nations ought to take several different steps to try to make the coming food crisis less severe. One thing is to forbid the sale of land in the countries of Africa to wealthy countries. Another is to forbid the use of food crops for motor fuel. The third one was to establish a global food bank. Yeah. That is the resources that are a reserve against a bad harvest are very small. The United Nations ought to buy up some fraction of the the crop and store it to have insurance. I think that one thing that we in Scandinavia can do is to look at our own industries and ask whether they're involved in producing armaments. And these armaments, are they being sent to conflict, to regions of conflict? And I think Holger Terp has done quite a lot of research on this to show that even in Denmark and also Sweden, the arms industry is very large, and the sending of armaments to conflict regions is a big source of profit. Of course, the members of the Security Council, the permanent members of the Security Council, are the worst offenders in this. The five permanent members of the Security Council are the biggest exporters of arms to the developing world. Yes, I think giving information to the public is very important. And that's why I admire your radio program so much, because it gives an alternative to the mass media, which are so bad about. They hardly ever give us a realistic picture of what is going on. But both you and Holger are working to create alternative media, and I think that's enormously important. There's something called YouTube, and perhaps we ought to use it more. You can make videos, your own videos, and put them onto YouTube, and you can even put them onto your homepage. And in our Pogosh group here in Denmark, we plan to do that. I can also tell you about a project that our Pogosh group has had. The Peace Academy has been involved with this too. And this is giving prizes on United Nations Day to student projects that are related to peace and to global problems and their solution, and also to the United Nations. So we began with this in 2008, and by now, last year, we had 9 gymnasiums involved, and each of them did its own thing, and they did different things, but it was a day in each of the gymnasiums where prizes were awarded for the student projects, and this huge enthusiasm. So it really worked. And the price of it, of course, was the cost of the prizes. And that was given to us by the Hermod Lanning Foundation. So we got 5,000 kroner for each of the 9 schools. Just to comment on the vegetarian point of view, that's an important point. A lot of the food crisis comes from the fact that people are shifting, for example, in China, to a diet that is heavier in meat. And that is related to greenhouse gases for the first place, because the cattle are producing ammonia. And it's also means that the food chain is longer, and the same amount of grain can feed more people if they have a lower percentage of meat in their diet. I think it would actually be a great help to FN Forbundet, to the Danish United Nations Association, to have your ideas, to have your enthusiasm for abolition of war and for strengthening and reforming the United Nations. I think that those ideas would be important to them. Well, it's been a huge privilege to be here. Thank you very, very much for coming.